You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeder.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, September 22nd, 2014. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, President of the American Federation of Teachers, Randy Weingarten. On teacher tenure, Common Core, education reform, and more. Also on the program, on the heels of, or I should say in the wake of, the largest climate change march in the history of the world yesterday in New York City. Well over 300,000 people marching in New York to press the world's governments to act on climate change. As we speak, thousands are marching in downtown New York City. The sit-in has already begun. Flood Wall Street is in effect. Sit-in as we speak around the Bull on Wall Street. We will give you updates over the course of the program on what's happening down there. It's a much more confrontational march downtown. The People's March was incredibly impressive. I was there with family yesterday. We'll talk about that later in the program. Certainly, some criticism of how cozy it was with a lot of institutions and establishment, but thus we're seeing Flood Wall Street right now as we speak. Other stories we'll be talking about over the course of the program. The Boggs nomination, you'll remember we talked about Michael Boggs some time ago, a Obama judicial nominee out of a deal struck with the two Republican senators of Georgia. His record on things like choice and the Confederate flag made him a very dubious choice for a Democratic president. It now appears that there is no support for that nomination, and he's being encouraged to pull his nomination. We will get to that. A St. Louis PR class for the police in St. Louis on how to deal with the media. Obamacare now hits 7.3 million paid customers, I guess, for health insurance, shooting past the OMB's prediction of 6 million. And Pam Geller is up to it again. There's going to be a new round of anti-Muslim ads on buses across New York City. We will get to all that and more. Just a reminder, folks, this program cannot exist without your support. You can become a member today. Go to jointhemajorityreport.com. To become a member, we need your support. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. And if you buy crap from Amazon, buy it through our link at MajorityReportKickback.com. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, Randy Weingarten. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program the president of the American Federation of Teachers, Randy Weingarten. Randy, welcome to the program.
It's great to be with you, Sam. Thank you.
So let's start at the Villagara case. We've discussed it quite a bit on this program. It dealt with what is known as teacher tenure, a California case that has spurred similar lawsuits around the country. Just, I mean, give us your take on the Villagara case in particular, but more generally speaking, these attacks on teacher tenure.
Right. So the Villagara case was funded by some Silicon Valley magnates finding some kids. And the kids had a really important point to make, which is that shouldn't all kids be entitled to great teachers who, you know, have the support they need and the tools and conditions they need and the, you know, and the competence they need to give kids a great education? So, you know, I want to make sure that we're clear that the issue that the kids were litigating, that they're entitled to a great public education, is the right issue. What happened is it's totally the wrong solution, and frankly, if the Villagara case actually became the law of the land in the United States of America, we'd actually be in much worse shape than we are right now. Because what they said was, instead of it being equity, you know, instead of, you know, dealing with the fact that two-thirds of the achievement gap is because of poverty or social, emotional, economic conditions, they basically said the one thing that we should take away is teachers' ability to stand up for their kids or have professional, exercise professional judgment in classes. And I think what's, and so this lower court said that the, you know, that the due process rules, the rules that are about, you know, teachers having that right to speak, teachers not being able to be fired except for just cause, that those were the real issues. And frankly, what we are seeing in the last couple of months is that a lot of people who have actually looked at it, you know, have said, wait a second, we need to attract and retain and support great teachers in hard-to-staff schools. So the worst thing you could do is take away their voice or anything that would actually help that happen. At the same time, if there are real issues, like there are in California, that it takes 18 months to get to, you know, to have these due process protections, let's look at that, because in most of the rest of the country, it takes about 3 years. And there shouldn't be cases that take 10 years to litigate. These cases should take, as they do now in New York, about 100 days to litigate. So fix what's broken, but don't actually take away one of the few emoluments that will, that helps us recruit and retain good teachers, particularly for the kids who need the most.
And I think there was a study that came out, I think it was only about 4 or 5 days ago, from Brookings, that that showed that, you know, to the extent that one can study this, that the absence of teacher tenure, which, you know, not to be confused with the tenure you one would get in higher education, just means that at one point you become eligible for a due process procedure. It doesn't end up providing better teachers, and in fact, it really isn't any more effective at getting rid of any teachers that aren't doing well. And
right.
But
That's what I'm saying. What's interesting is that in the last few months, as people are really kind of studying and thinking about the issue of due process, even Brookings has said due process actually doesn't hurt. The Brookings study disproved the people who say get rid of tenure. The Brookings study says basically tenure has nothing to do with whether you have a qualified teacher, and in fact getting rid of it would actually make it worse because it's something that teachers need to exercise their professional judgment or to stand up for kids. So one of these odd sources it was a conservative researcher. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of like strange bedfellows for the point that I just made. But you're also right, Sam, that K-12 tenure is not Supreme Court tenure and it's not higher ed tenure. It's just cause dismissal, meaning there needs to be real cause before a teacher is dismissed in K-12. That's what it means.
And so what does this speak? I mean, this attack on tenure, I mean, just taking a broader view, I know that in New York State we're dealing with similar lawsuits. And in fact, there were two different lawsuits ongoing, and the so-called reformers are fighting as to who gets the glory in leading this this case. But more broadly speaking, why do you perceive teachers as being the if we know from studies that that we don't have some type of rampant massive problem with low-quality teachers, because like you say, there's a lot of studies that back up the notion that poverty accounts for a huge amount of our education disparity. From the perspective of the so-called reform movement, why make teachers the scapegoat here?
So this has been going on for, you know, 10 years now, and I think that, and you had an issue with Dana Goldston, who's written a terrific book. But I think there's two reasons. One is political, and one is economic. And actually, there's a third reason, and that's emotional. Let me do the emotional and the economic reasons first. In a capitalist democracy, in our capitalist democracy, pretty much the only service we give, even though we talk about economic opportunity, we talk about educational opportunity, but the only service that every state in the nation has tried to figure out how to do is public education, with the view that if we help educate our children, that our children can then seize their own lives. And so we pay taxes policing, and we pay taxes for public education. But it's really, other than safety, the only service we do. And so what happens is that in a period of time like this, right after the greatest, you know, recession since the Great Depression, when you had both, you know, budgets being cut across the country, and you also had education being one of the, you know, still the biggest items that we spent money on in an economy that was not generating a lot of income. So think about what happened. The austerity mongers and the privateers kind of got together, and because we're schizophrenic about teachers, We think of them as incredible heroes, and then we vilify them if they can't do exactly what we've asked them to do, which is basically be the first responders of everything. And so I think what you saw is, think about it, from 2006, 7 on, you saw that with austerity taking hold, more and more vilification of teachers. And with people who were in ed tech and others trying to figure out how to make a buck, you saw this kind of, you know, constellation, convergence of the Jeb Bushes of the world and the ed tech industry, of Silicon Valley and the so-called reformers. And so you're seeing all of that together. And so that's why I'm saying it's kind of economic and it's kind of political. And the other thing you see is you see the fact that at this point in time, teacher unions between the NEA and the AFT, we pretty much have more density than pretty much any other union. And so if you don't want the Democratic Party to succeed, or you don't want people who, you know, think public education is important to succeed, then you go after those messengers. And so that's why when you see who's funding these lawsuits, I am told that the Koch brothers are now funding a lot of these lawsuits. Who the Walmart Foundation, Silicon Valley, the hedge funders who fund, you know, Eva Moskowitz's charter schools. So that's part of the reason why we say follow the money. Now, having said that, are there things we need to do? Of course there are things we need to do. But at the end of the day, the only real opportunity agent in the United States of America to create a middle class and to give opportunity to all children has been public education and the labor movement. And those are the two things that are under attack like never before by lots and lots of people who have a lot of money.
Is the notion of education as a mechanism in which to deal with things like building a middle class and income inequality, is that problematic from sort of a rhetorical or a political standpoint? Because in some ways, education is being asked to address a problem which in many respects prohibits education from happening. In other words, when we talk about education fighting poverty, isn't that sort of putting the cart before the horse, that in some ways that we need to deal with poverty before we get any real movement on education, educational right. outcomes for people?
So, I mean, the answer to all of this is yes, yes, and no, no, meaning that we don't have the luxury of being able to deal with things in a linear fashion. We live in a dynamic universe, and we have children every single day who are being born, and we have an obligation in this country, thank God, to try to help create a lot of opportunity for kids. So you don't have so in the past, people understood that education was an opportunity agent. It wasn't a guarantor. And so you would try to then put other conditions in for success. So consequently, what you just raised, Sam, is just how complicated things are, that an individual teacher cannot do this alone, that we do have to do a bunch of strategies together. But frankly, if you do those bunch of strategies together, you can help change outcomes for children. And so one of the things that you can do in terms of directly addressing poverty is what we've done in McDowell County, West Virginia, by having a public-private partnership to deal with a lot of the issues that create poverty. And what we're doing in Cincinnati with wraparound services around schools, where you help, where you work with community, and you think about, instead of closing public schools like they're doing in Chicago or Philadelphia, you invest in public schools, not just instructionally, but you also invest in terms of how the services that kids need that can help mitigate poverty, and the services that parents need as well. So you know, dental services, health services, making sure that we're feeding kids after school so that kids have a place to go. Saturdays and Sundays, having workforce development, community college services. And at the same time, as I hope you've noticed, our union, as well as other unions, are fighting to raise the minimum wage, because you can't keep on having a race to the bottom in terms of, you know, living wages in this country. So these are all connected, but we as educators should never be in a position where we say, wait, we're going to take care of poverty and social mobility first and income inequality first, and then we'll educate kids. We have to try to do both, but that's why it's so galling when people demonize the very people who are trying to do all of it and be those first responders.
I mean, let's talk about that movement. One of the recently, I think you and the AFT pledged $1 million to Karen Lewis's potential run. And in the event that she right. ends up running, she, of course, the head of the Chicago Public Schools Union, successfully struck 2 years ago, I guess now, and has signaled that she may run against Rahm Emanuel. I mean, talk about the Chicago Teachers Union in terms of a model, you know, in the context of this social justice unionism, where you talk about dealing with these other issues that impact people around the schools, and versus business unionism. Is there a specific model that can that social justice movement that came out of Chicago, is that a model for the national union, or is that a model that has to happen on a more local level?
So, you know, this is what's interesting. The social justice movement that Chicago practices is something that you see throughout our union, but because it was a strike, it got much more focus than when others, like St. Paul, Minnesota, do it, because they had a successful conclusion absent a strike of their contract negotiations. So, you know, in some ways, you know, Karen and the CTU had no choice but to strike because of the conditions under which, because of the climate that Rahm Emanuel created. So I would actually take the work that's being done in. So the short answer is yes, we need to do both, because education is a social justice issue. Our communities are social justice issues. And, you know, our union needs to be, and we have become more, you know, solution-driven, community-engaged, and member-empowered. Because if you don't do all three of those things, you are not actually creating both a more just society as well as a society that is more respectful of the work in which, you know, our members do. So that's basically our theory of the case, is that you can't be an insurance, you can't be, you know, the insurance company, you know, as a union there when you need it. You have to be much more dynamic and be about how we help the community move things that are important for our community. And, you know, that if you look at our mission, that's what our mission says, and we try to animate it in lots and lots of different ways. So it was practiced in a different way in Chicago, I think, very, very well, but it was because you had a boss that was totally intransigent and to all of these different issues. Fast forward, look at New York right now. New York voted in a progressive mayor, and you have a new contract that the UFT has worked through with the new mayor that is about how you help schools, you know, turn around. And the kind of wraparound services that, you know, Karen was talking about with guidance counselors and nurses in New York, you have a mayor who's saying, we need to do that the right way. You have a mayor who actually went to Cincinnati with us a couple of years ago to see how to do that right. So different approaches to trying to solve the same problems, which are how do we ensure that all kids get a decent shot at life, which is how do you ensure that kids are treated, you treat the entire child, and how do you make sure that we are a social justice movement about retirement security for all, about living wages for all, about great educational opportunities for all.
And how does that, I mean, translate? It's always struck me that teachers are sort of optimally positioned to be able to have these relationships with the broader community because, you know, as a parent, I send my kid to school. I want to have a relationship with my child's teacher. How is it possible? I mean, is this a model for other unions as well? You know, because we're obviously unions, broadly speaking, are under attack. Public
under
employees,
attack.
Broadly speaking, are under attack. Is there a model here for other unions, and how would they go about doing that?
I think there is. You know, Sam, I think there is. We spent a lot of time at the last AFL-CIO convention talking about how our relationships with community, with our broader community, because, you know, we're all part of community, you know, but our relationships with our broader community need to be much more transformational and much less transactional. But it has to start with everyone walking, you know, creating a trust and walking in each other's shoes. And I think what's happened is, you know, in the 1970s, before the oil crisis, before the huge changes economically that changed our nation very, in some ways, you know, for the worse, you had 30, one out of every three worker, and whatever every three people were in labor unions. Now, in the private sector, it's maybe one out of 10. And so when all of a sudden, you know, your community, people don't intuitively know, well, it's that labor union that has helped to fight to get you, you know, at least a cost of living increase, have some retirement security, have a day off or so when you need it, you know, being able to, you know, have a sick day without getting fired, having some voice at work so that you don't get fired because you're making too much money or because, you know, you said something that the boss didn't like. You don't have that, you know, you don't have that density left anymore in most communities in America. And so you have to recreate it in lots of different ways. And one of the ways to recreate it is for the labor movement to do many, many more things with the broader community. I think that you saw that in terms of the fight in Ohio over SB 5, the bill that Kasich tried to get through to gut collective bargaining. The labor movement got it on the ballot. And the difference between, I think, SB 5 and winning that and losing the recall elections in Wisconsin was we made a case to the broader community that collective bargaining actually was helpful to the day-to-day experience of Americans in Ohio, that collective bargaining made sure that, you know, people who were in the fire department had, you know, were able to, firefighters were able to have a voice at work and help. And that helped them effectively fight fires, that teachers having a voice at work effectively helped them help special needs kids, and the same in terms of police. And in Wisconsin, we weren't able to make that argument. So I think this is for the broader, you know, the broader labor movement to learn. But what we've done in education K through 12 or pre-K through 12 is that we make the fights that community needs and community has been with us to ensure that kids get a decent shot at life. And that's why in Pennsylvania, for example, the number one issue in Pennsylvania in this election is education funding. In the suburbs, it's because the cuts that Corbett did actually has shown up as an increase in property taxes in the suburbs. And in the cities like Philadelphia and Pittsburgh, the cuts have starved schools so that kids are not getting the shot that they need for success later on. And instead of Corbett being able to pit our, you know, teachers and teacher unions versus community, if you look in Philadelphia, the community, the parents, clergy, and teachers are all together fighting back the cynical policies of Governor Corbett.
On a national level, on a federal level, I mean, give me your sense of has the Obama administration been sufficiently enough of a break? Have they moved in a different direction? In other words, is race to the top really any more appropriate than No Child Left Behind has become from your perspective?
Look, honestly, race to the top was No Child Left Behind on steroids. It's not, you know, it was, I have a lot of admiration for the president, and I think what he did was no less than heroic in the stimulus bill. He inherited a terrible economy, and he helped keep the economy humming, and he helped keep it on a lifeline. And what he did with the stimulus bill was help communities all throughout the country be on a lifeline, and nobody gives him the credit that he deserves on that. Having said that, they had just the wrong theory of the case in terms of education. What they did, when I say it's a race to the top, was No Child Left Behind on steroids, is because when No Child Left Behind, the things that continued in No Child Left Behind was this fixation on test and punish, test and sanction, that all you had to do essentially is just shake kids and teachers up and sanction and use test scores and say that those test scores were going to be used for promotional, for whether a kid was promoted or not, whether a teacher was fired or not, and whether a school closed or not. And none of the infrastructure, that was supposed to be promised as part of No Child Left Behind, like the funding for reading programs, like more Title I money, like how you create the supports for kids, none of that materialized, but only the sanctions. And so there were people who supported, the president, who basically said, well, we just weren't, religious enough about this in terms of the sanctions. So that's why all of a sudden testing became part of teacher evaluation and testing became part of mass closure of schools. And so now 4 years later, 6 years later, people are saying that basically it didn't really work. It hasn't moved the needle in any real way. It didn't really work. And what you're starting to see is people going to what are the things that really will work? Creating collaboration. Having critical thinking skills, building relationships, teaching persistence. And so, frankly, I've actually been in 7 states in the last couple of weeks and seeing really good stuff in different schools, where people are actually collaborating and listening on a bottom-up way, where they are fixing rather than closing neighborhood schools, where they are doing a whole bunch of things to help kids critically think, including the interventions and the enrichments that are necessary to do that for whole classes. And fourth, that, you're seeing the kind of a focus on the needs of the whole child, music, art, the wraparound services that I was talking about. So, I think that the administration is going to have a very mixed view on what its signature proposal was, but I'm also giving the president a lot of credit right now because he's seeing it, and he has said that there's too much testing and that needs to stop, and the SIG grants, the vehicle by which they were doing a lot of school closures, the things that we raised about 6 years ago about what needed to be changed or what needed to be done, some of that was done in these new regulations. And as you know, our members basically put the secretary on a school improvement plan, on an improvement plan, saying, focus on equity. Stop the test fixation. Let's have a learning fixation. Let's actually help deal with social immobility and segregation and income inequality. And also think about what the real solutions to VGARA are, which is how do you attract and retain teachers to work in some of the toughest places.
I know the NEA has called for Arne Duncan's resignation. I mean, do you feel that the Arne Duncan has there been some 180-degree shift here? is what we're seeing with Common Core indicative of? I mean, well, give me your sense of Common Core as to. I know that a lot of the people I've talked to, you know, ranging from my local principal to other educators, have said that the real problem with Common Core is a function of where testing falls into that and the,
exactly
and the implementation
exactly. About 2 years ago, I mean, the NEA convention comes before our convention, and the NEA basically said that Duncan should be fired. What our convention did, our members are just, I mean, it's not that they're angry, they're frustrated, and they feel like, let us have what we need to help children. Stop with all these top-down dictates. We need the money. We need the equity. We need what LBJ tried to do in terms of Title I by actually, you know, helping kids who have the least. But they're like, let us have a little flexibility in terms of how we do what we need to do to help kids. And so what our convention did is put the secretary on an improvement plan and said, you know, just like we deserve due process, the secretary deserves due process. And this is an improvement plan, and that it focused on creating a different climate in terms of teachers being, you know, you can create a different climate in the United States, not a climate that scapegoats and vilifies teachers. And the secretary can use his bully pulpit to do that. So that was one piece. The other piece is when you have 25% of kids in poverty, you need to have an equity agenda. Saying that every kid deserves to have a great education is great rhetoric, but how do you back that up? And the third was stop with the test fixation and start with the teaching and learning fixation. And that gets back to what you just said in terms of Common Core, which is 2 years ago, I said there should be a moratorium on high-stakes testing associated with Common Core. Get it right before you even make a count. And long-term, what Linda Darling-Hammond and myself and others have said is let's have different measures for how you make it count, meaning, you know, do things like project-based instruction and other kinds of things, which is more akin to what critical thinking skills are and what, frankly, all the private schools in the United States do. They don't have standardized tests in this kind of way. They have SATs, they have ACTs, but they don't have a standardized test for every child every year, nor do schools, you know, in the world. No other nation has testing every child every year as accountability piece. And so what your principal said and what most teachers say about Common Core is that, yeah, there's a lot of it that has real potential. I think there's a lot of it that has real promise. But let us get our hands around it. Let us actually figure out how to teach it. Let us get the supports for kids, because teaching based upon critical thinking and going deeper with kids and asking them to explain things and coming up with various different ways to get to the right answer, that's a really different way of teaching, and it's a different way kids learn than just rote memorization. And so what happened in lots of places is that they were tested before kids were taught. And so whereas Pent and Pearson and others may have done very, very well in the last few years, what has happened is that it's created huge trust issues that the school systems don't know what the hell they're doing, because they're just basically testing, as opposed to really helping kids and teachers navigate through this transition.
And so how is Dunking doing at this point? I mean, you put him on a program. I know it's early, but he doesn't have too much time left. I mean, how is?
I would say it's still a work in progress.
Yeah. And where are we on this? You mentioned Pearson. The idea that teachers cannot look at the tests even after they've been administered.
It's crazy. It's really nuts.
I mean, we've had teachers, frankly, who have sent us stuff in anonymously. My child is in fourth grade now. She had tests last year as well. My daughter's teacher was literally in tears after administering that test. She felt it was so unfair for the kids, but she can't talk about it.
It is really, I mean, we did an action at the Pearson shareholders meeting, right in late April, or mid-April, I think, late or mid-April, I'm now losing the track of time, right after the New York State exams were administered, the New York State supposedly Common Core aligned exams were administered, and over 17,000 people sent the board of directors of Pearson email saying, get rid of the gag order. And this is what they do. They point fingers at, so this is how there's no accountability or transparency, you know, in the higher ups. This is what they did. They immediately just pointed fingers at the New York State education apparatus and said, well, that's the contract that we signed. So we're like, so you think that this was a good thing to do? You think just because the state signed a contract with you saying that there's a gag order, that is okay? Or is this really the best practice? No, they said. No, the best practice would be more transparency and would be that kind of immediate feedback. But this is the reason, Sam, as that people are told, parents and teachers are totally frustrated with a lot of what's happening with Common Core. It makes no, these rules make no sense. They make no common sense, and they seem at on face level to be not only counterintuitive, but that they hurt children. And so why do you have those rules? They have those rules because of money. Because the state in New York, for example, doesn't want to spend the money on regenerating questions or reformulating questions that they believe are accurate or reliable. So they want to keep these questions hidden so that they can use them again. So once again, the priority is not children, the priority is the finances. And so, you know, that's why people are so frustrated about it. These gag orders should go. It's crazy. If you give a test to children, you need to actually talk to kids and their parents about it immediately. I don't care if it's a standardized test. I don't care if it's your own classroom test. That's what you need to do in order to make it a real assessment of work. And if you want to use it as a way of kids learning and getting the feedback they need, if you want to use it as a gotcha, you do exactly what's going on right now.
And so what's next? I mean, should people be agitating against the state to spend more money so that Pearson can regenerate these tests? Is it, I mean, what's left at this stage?
So the first piece is that tests should not be so highly consequential. That's the first piece. Because if tests were not the key ingredient to, if learning and if teaching and learning and teachers and principals and district superintendents had more of a role on what actually constituted success in schooling and tests had less of a role, then Pearson wouldn't have, then you wouldn't even have this question. Because, you know, there would be maybe a standardized test. It would inform data. It would not be so consequential. You didn't need it to be so supposedly, you know, reliable or, you know, all the psychometric things that go along with all this stuff. So number one is, this is a good example of why tests should not be so consequential. And they should not be, they should be about improving, about you know, giving feedback, not about whether a child gets promoted or not, you know, and then finds out basically 6 months later, or a teacher's evaluation depends on it, and she finds out 6 months later, on and on and on. That's number one. Number two, there should be more funding for schools. But the question becomes, we should actually know the real cost of what all this testing is. And you don't know the real cost when it gets hidden by somebody reusing test questions. And you also don't, you know, and also there should be fewer and fewer, you know, days, you know, focused on testing or test prep or things like that. Two districts in the last, someone, I was just in Florida on Saturday, and one of the parents were telling me that in Palm Beach County, over 80 days are now dedicated in one way or another to testing. 80. In Pittsburgh, they just moved from cutting it in half from like 75 days to 35 days. So this notion, so, you know, you can, we can say the contract should change between New York State and, you know, Pearson so that they should disclose the test. Yes, that should be a piece of it. But the real problem is that this, that the accountability system is so based upon sanctions and blame and punishment as opposed to us actually asking the questions. Have kids, have we taught it? Have kids learned it? What are the skills that we want kids to know? We want them to become critical thinkers. We want them to develop trusting, great relationships with themselves and with adults. We want them to have the skills of resilience and persistence. And we want them to have a joy every now and then in terms of going to school. We want schools to be places where parents want to send their kids and educators want to work and kids are engaged. And so if we actually thought about our accountability system in that way, the skills we want kids to have and what we actually want schools to look like, instead of thinking about everything through the lens of testing, we'd be a lot better off, and most importantly, kids would be a lot better off.
Randy Weingarten, President of the American Federation of Teachers, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you, Sam.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back in the better half, we're going to be talking, hopefully if all goes well, to Sarah Jaffe, who is down at the Flood Wall Street protests. This is day two, really, of climate change protests in New York as the UN, about 130 countries meet at the UN. I think it's today in particular, but discussions will take place over the course of the week. But today in particular, to try and set up some mechanism, not a treaty, but involving benchmarks, essentially just to move the ball forward. The problem, of course, is that the political process may be incremental, but the warming of the planet is getting far less so incremental. All right, we got to take a break. Well, I'll give some responses, obviously, to what Weingarten had to say. But I think, you know, what's quite clear is if you diminish the importance of test scores as a currency, which implicates children moving forward in school, schools being closed, schools being funded, teachers being fired, as the importance of test scores diminish, it opens up all sorts of opportunities and cost savings, frankly. The state doesn't have to worry about people looking to find out how they're going to score better on a Common Core test if it's not so tight, if there isn't such high stakes involved in it. Teachers aren't going to have to teach to the test. They're not going to have to spend resources and time in basically just teaching the kids how to score well on a test so that the school gets funding, so that education gets funding in general. I mean, it is a huge mess. And the only, I guess, sort of silver lining here is that it's becoming clear as we get more analysis of how well or not well charters are doing, we get more analysis as how Race to the Top and all of these high-stake testing regimes are doing, we begin to realize that, like, you know, at the end of the day, they're not working. And supposedly it's causing a little bit of panic in the corporate education reform movement, because their own, live by the sword, die by the sword, I guess, their own data points are showing that what they're doing is not effective. So at one point you just have people who are just exclusively, it's made up of people, not just who think that they're right because they're wealthy, but also people who are just trying to extract money from the system. All right, we're going to take a break. Speaking of extraction, when we come back, hopefully we will have we're going to the better half. Hopefully we'll have Sarah Jaffe on the line. We'll be right back after this.